that type of budget, you should have two riders that are capable of winning. Because Chris, one crash, boom, he's out.
What went wrong last year? I crashed. I fell off my bike.
Halfway through the massage, there's a knock on the door, and it's Ryder, standing there with a cup for me. Made you a juice, Dave.
What's quite worrying is we're still in Derbyshire, and it feels like we've been cycling for a week.
Morale good, though?
No, not really.
With exclusive interviews and the best analysis on two wheels, this is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Daniel Freib.
Hello.
And it's not Lionel. It's Rob Hatch.
Hello, hello.
Hello, Rob. Thanks very much for joining us. Standing in for the absent Lionel. Lionel will be back at some point. He'll be back next week. I'll be away next week, but Lionel will be back. So, Rob, thanks for taking some time off from your Eurosport commentary duties. And you're going to stand in for Lionel in giving us a weekly roundup.
Now,
the pressure's on.
So I'm told.
The pressure's on here. This could really force Lionel to up his game, but he does the normal weekly roundup. You're going to go for it. Go for it, Rob. Go on.
The headline race was the Ennekor Tour, won by Tim Wellens on Dutch and Belgian roads for a second successive year, and notable for its exciting race in horrible weather and finishing op de mur. Up in the north, it was barbecue weather when Ryan Taramaya was the winner of the third edition of the Arctic Race of Norway. Ireland's Sam Bennett took a huge sprint win on stage two. There was also racing in France, where Nasser Bouhanni returned to winning ways and Alexandre Geniez took the overall prize at the Tour de l'Ain. The Czech Tour took a huge step forward in terms of publicity, Fernando Gaviria throwing his hat into the ring as the future sprint man at Etix Quickstep. Petr Vakoc was the GC victor. On the track, the current Quickstep super sprinter Mark Cavendish was in Madison action in Derby, victorious with Brad Wiggins at the Revolution event.
That was fantastic, Rob. I think everybody in the National Theatre is now fully appraised of what's been going on in the last week in cycling. That was brilliant. No, thank you very much.
That's the idea, isn't it? We're raising the profile of cycling.
You're the new Ciro Scagnomelio. Fantastic. Well, no, that was a very comprehensive roundup. There has been a lot of racing going on. We're going to talk a little bit about the racing that's been going on and the latest transfer news, and then we're going to look ahead to the Vuelta a España, the third Grand Tour, which begins this weekend. Now, Rob, you did something Lionel never does there. You looked up what accents correspond to what sounds. It's fantastic. Their pronunciation was fantastic.
I hope I've got that right. For any Czech listeners, you can let us know. I might have balls that one up completely.
No, that sounded good to me. So, listen, that was a roundup. Let's. Which race do you want to start with? You've been commentating on the Arctic race, Rob. So that seems like a good one. How was that? Daniel was there last year, of course.
Well, it was brilliant weather for the last two stages, at least. It said barbecue weather. It was 23 degrees. It was actually warmer than it was in London for the last two stages. The scenery as ever was spectacular. A lot of people on the roads. I think they probably broke records for that this year. I think they concentrated more on cities and towns and getting people involved rather than the big wilderness ride that we had last year all the way down from the North Cape through the middle of nowhere. Very unique landscapes, as I said, and some pretty unique racing as well. Six-man teams. A few teams only sent him five riders. Alexander Kristoff got his win and he got to wear the leader's jersey. But there were some really good climbers in the race. The likes of Matthias Frank there. Astana took Tano Kanga and Ryan Taramaya was the overall winner. BMC had a strong team. Ben Hermans took the third stage, which was the queen stage in inverted commas, with a 4 kilometre climb at about 7% at the end of the stage. But he couldn't hold on to the jersey. The final day they had this very, very, very competitive sort of worlds-type course, if you will. It was only a 5, 6, 7 kilometre circuit, but it had a really, really strong climb in at 2.5 kilometres, 8%, raced four times, and that broke the race up completely. Hermann's having a mechanical, messing it up, not getting back in enough and not having enough left to chase on when the attacks came thick and fast. Three riders went away at the end. Zakarin was there, we saw earlier in the season in Romandy. Taramaya attacking to take the overall win, but the stage winner, Sylvain Dillier, salvaging something, I suppose, for BMC. But no, really good racing, and I think it's a race that's continuing to be on the up. One other line of news that came from the week was the fact that Statoil, who backed the race, the oil company up in Norway, have continued to sponsor it for another 3 years.
Also some chat of a Norwegian pro team being set up by Tor Hushovd, who retired last year, of course. Do you know a timescale for that, Daniel? Have you heard any rumours?
Not really. I know that a salmon farming company has been mooted as the potential sponsor. Salmon, of course, was very much in the news at the Arctic race because I think, weren't they offering 50
kilos, 500 kilos of salmon at intermediate sprints. Was there a salmon jersey as well?
It was the King of the Mountains jersey, actually. And it was salmon-coloured. And, yeah, there were 500 kilos of salmon given out each day on the podium to those who went over the biggest climb of the day. So it was an innovation, let's say.
Salmon-coloured kit would certainly be eye-catching, wouldn't it? I'm not sure if that would incur the wrath of certain people. And Brian Cookson was very outspoken. A similar coloured kit of that Colombian women's team last year didn't perhaps go down that well. But we'll see what happens. I can't imagine Tor Hushov having a team with kit that colour, can you? He's a very stylish man.
He is. It just reminds me, there's a Spanish football team that's just revealed their new kit with Iberico ham as the backdrop, and their away kit is broccoli. It's just a collage of broccoli. Back on to more pressing, relevant matters. The scene in Norway really is booming, though, isn't it? The calendar they have now with the Tour of the Fjord, the Tour of Norway, and the Arctic race. We saw Dag Otto Lauritzen, who I spoke about a lot at with my special bulletin.
You did a special bulletin last year, Daniel, from the Archery. It's very worthwhile going back, listeners, and having another listen to that. A really historic piece of broadcasting. You crashed a hen party at one point, didn't you? You interviewed members of a hen party in the course of that. It was really groundbreaking stuff.
Heady days they were, Richard.
Rob, you got any news on the mooted Norwegian team?
Well, there was a line in the weekend on Twitter doing the rounds in various different news outlets that Tor Hushov was wanting to put together a team that had two spearheads, really, Alexander Kristoff and Edvald Boasson Hagen. He wanted the best Norwegian riders to ride together, so watch this space on that one.
Well, that'd be obvious, wouldn't it, I think?
Well, difficult to put together, though, I'd say, given the fact that they've got similar objectives.
That's true. The Eneco Tour was also on, Daniel. Did you see much of the Eneco Tour?
Yep, did you see much of the Eneco Tour, Richard?
I didn't watch much of it, actually, I must confess. I've been saving myself for the Vuelta.
Well, belting race, as always, the Eneco Tour. It's a bit of a hipster favourite for the late season on paper. Doesn't sound like a very exciting proposition, a stage race in Belgium and Holland, but they managed to jam in a lot of different formats, the classic style races, into that 1 week of racing. So there was a stage over the Ardennes, a lot of the climbs we've seen, Liège-Bastogne-Liège, and there was a climb, as Rob said, finishing halfway up the Mur van Gerardsbergen. Notable, very notable performances. Tim Vellens is really developing well. Lotto Soudal have a very good young team, a lot of good young Belgian riders who are really progressing well there. Thijs Benoot was very notable again, who we saw prominent in the classics earlier this year, fifth in the Tour of Flanders, wasn't he, in his first Tour of Flanders as a neopro. So I think those were the real take home. Well, the performance of Vellens again was one real take home from the Eneco Tour.
Thijs Benoot finishing eighth overall at the Eneco Tour, of course. Van Avermaet finishing second, very regular, of course, as always.
Always second as well.
Well,
often.
Often. Just don't talk about the Tour de France, we'll forget that one. Wilco Kelderman in third, Philippe Gilbert fourth, Fellini with another good ride. He was excellent in the spring, remember, for Trek. No Cancellara, of course, here. He's going to go and rest the Vuelta, we're told. So, fifth place for Fellini overall. And just really good racing, bad weather, exciting, lots of crowds. It's like being back in the spring all over again, really.
Yeah, I mean, I said I didn't watch much. I do actually like the Eneco Tour. I don't think a lot of the riders like it a great deal, just I think partly because of the timing. It's odd timing. It tends to be quite dangerous racing as well. There's a lot of road furniture. But it's kind of odd, isn't it, to see some of the classic specialists re-emerge from their summer hibernation. Guys like Steen Vandenberg, who you only really see in the cobbled classics, and then he disappears and re-emerges in August at the Eneco Tour.
It could be an important man next month, though, because I know that Belgium have got a lot of hopes of doing something at the World Championships, probably with Tom Bonham, maybe with someone else. That's going to be a hard decision to make if you're in charge of that team. But with the Worlds coming up, the course we have this year, Eneco Tour could be an even more important race.
As you mentioned, the Worlds, Rob, just before we take a short break, a little reminder that we had a special episode last week from the RAFA Cycle Club in Manchester. It was a discussion with Rod Ellingworth, the performance manager at Team Sky, and Dr. Richard Usher and myself, and that was recorded in front of an audience a couple of weeks ago, and it's a very interesting insight into the Tour de France. But Rod Ellingworth also spoke about the World Championship course in Richmond coming up and what kind of rider that might favour. He tipped Mark Cavendish if he's in the kind of form that he was in at the British Road Race Championships, but made it very clear that Great British team will not go with a single leader, that there will be several riders who it might suit.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Join us on Twitter and Facebook. Just search online for the Cycling Podcast.
So I mentioned the World Championship road race there. Again, that special podcast is available to listen to from the Rafa Cycle Club. And Rod Ellingworth talking about Mark Cavendish's prospects at the World Road Race Championships. Mark Cavendish, as Rob mentioned in his roundup, was in action at the weekend on the track, riding in Derby at the Revolution meeting. He rode the Omnium and finished second to Ed Clancy, which he described as encouraging. Made it clear that he was riding just really to keep his options open for the Rio Olympics next year. It's not to be taken as any kind of guarantee that that's going to be a big target for him. And he rode the Madison with Bradley Wiggins, first time since 2008, since they rode the Olympic final, I guess, in 2008 in Beijing. And they won that, as expected. Daniel, do we read anything into Cavendish riding on the track? If only that we know it's in sort of defiance of Patrick Lefebvre's wishes. I remember when he rode at Ghent a couple of years ago, even Lefebvre made it clear that he wasn't particularly happy about him riding the track. We suspect that Cavendish is going to leave Etics Quickstep. Is this sort of further sign that that's the most likely scenario?
It could be. I think Lefebvre was aware that he was going to do these couple of races. I think he's going to do another one on the track.
He didn't just read about it on the internet.
And, or hear it in the podcast. No, I think he knew about this before the Tour de France. And I think his position softened on it to a certain extent. I think the equipment that Cavendish was going to use was another issue that had to be resolved, whether he was going to ride a Specialized bike, which Specialized obviously sponsor his team. I think it's a very good thing for Cavendish, and it's something he's tried to reintroduce back into his riding slowly over the past couple of years, obviously with a view to Rio and the Omnium, but also with a view to regaining some of that leg speed, which was really so crucial to his success earlier in his career. And I think he's been very aware that he's lost some of that, and I suppose it remains to be seen whether he can transfer what he is gaining on the track. And you know, the week he spent before this Derby event training on the track, that was probably more important than the event itself in terms of, you know, reprogramming him to something like, you know, the Mark Cavendish we used to know in 2007. But yeah, let's see if he can take some of that onto the road.
I mean, it's an interesting one. It's not just a case of him going off to Rio and riding the Omnium. The British team, Heiko Salzwedel, the endurance coach, has made it clear that the only way he would ride the Omnium is if he's part of the Team Pursuit squad, the sort of fifth man in the Team Pursuit. And again, he's not just going to go there having not trained with the Team Pursuit guys. They're making all sorts of demands about him, you know, basing himself in Manchester, really committing to that Team Pursuit effort. You know, the fifth man isn't just somebody who flies in at the last moment. That's going to be very difficult, isn't it? And that's something he's going to have to weigh up. I mean, he's not going to want to, or he's not going to be able to miss the Tour de France in order to focus on riding the track at Rio, is he?
No, you wouldn't think so. And Heiko Salzwedel gets on very well with Cav. You know, it's someone with whom Cavendish has history going back 10, 12 years. I think Heiko Salzwedel saw him first at the Tour of Berlin in about 2004 and was very impressed by him, thought he reminded him very much of Robbie McEwen. But if he's placing those demands on Cavendish, I just wonder if that's put some doubts in Cav's mind about the whole Rio Olympic bid. I mean, he's very aware of the coverage that his career has had in terms of not having won, well, really being the only one in this generation of very prominent British riders not to have won an Olympic medal. And I think he wants to redress that, not so much for himself, but in terms of the public's perception. And I think it does great with him still when he doesn't get recognition that some of the track riders have got.
Well, on the subject of Cavendish and possible transfer, and there's no updates on where he might go this week, but Rob, you were talking about Arctic Race earlier. Ryan Taramai is out of contract at the end of the season. He's at Astana. Have you any inkling about where he's going to go, or anyone else? Have you heard any other transfer gossip?
No, I think he'd like to go back a little further west, to Western Europe, to a more traditional team, I've heard. And it was funny, as soon as he crossed the line, the winner on Sunday, his agent was the first to congratulate him. He was there talking to him. I wonder if there are a few more telephone conversations, because the week before he won the Vuelta a Burgos, when Miguel Ángel López messed up on the final day, and early in the season, of course, he won the Vuelta a Murcia. So three very, very big wins for a guy who, for a couple of years, hasn't really done anything.
Sort of disappeared. Contract year, innit? We'll mention before we go on to the Vuelta, just briefly, because you're commentating this week for British Eurosport on the USA Pro Challenge. Such a weird name for a race that takes part in a beautiful part of the world and really, I think, should be called the Tour of Colorado, shouldn't it?
It's the Tour of Colorado, you and I, but USA Pro Challenge, America's greatest race, as I like to call it.
Didn't it happen last week, didn't it? Didn't Jason Day win by three shots from Jordan Spieth? Oh, no, that was the USPGA.
I have no idea what you're talking about, Daniel.
Sorry, that was USPGA.
You're getting your podcast mixed up. USA Pro Challenge, Tour of Colorado. Tour de Colorado.
They wouldn't stand for that.
The tour back in the 90s, Tour de Trump, it was sponsored by the man who might be the next president of the USA, Donald Trump. But some of you might know that Donald Trump was involved in cycling in the 90s, briefly flirted with cycling and sponsored the Tour de Trump, which showcased the talents, if I recall correctly, of a young Lance Armstrong, perhaps. Or it was Tour DuPont, and I think Greg LeMond rode it when it was the Tour de Pont. Then it became the Tour de Trump, isn't that right?
The young Lance Armstrong before he was controversial. He wasn't controversial then, was he, really?
Well, actually, we'd learn now that he actually was controversial then, because he admitted last week that he actually was controversial all the way back in 1993.
But when was the Tour de Trump? Anyway, let's go on, let's move on.
Oh, yeah, sorry, let's move on. So the USA Pro Challenge, we're recording on Tuesday, so this will go out Thursday morning, but we can only talk about the first stage, but that was won by Taylor Finney, and what a great story that is, because Taylor Finney, of course, had a terrible crash a bit over a year ago in the US National Championships in the road race on the descent. He fell, he was hit by a motorbike, terrible, terrible wounds, terrible scars on his legs. I'm not alone, I don't think, in thinking at various points this year that he would never come back, that he would never race again. And he won stage one.
I think outwardly everybody was trying to be very positive about Taylor Finney because he's a popular guy in the peloton, and this of course is the big good news story of this part of the late season, I think. But inwardly everybody had their own worries, as you said. I know that in private conversations with a lot of people, there were people who were very, very worried about maybe not seeing Taylor Finney racing again. But USA Pro Challenge, his home state of Colorado, stage one, a lot of things happening on that circuit around Steamboat Springs. It was a circuit race, two laps, 156 kilometres. And the racing sort of exploded on the final King of the Mountains, the final little climb. We had a group going away of GC guys. That all sort of settled down a little. Finney himself was actually dropped on the climb, got back on the descent, a long, long descent, about 30, 40 kilometres towards the end. And we had Rowan Dennis away with Guillaume Boivin, the Canadian national champion. Dennis looked as though alongside Boivin they were going to sort of ride on and take maybe a 5-10 second win and pick out the leader's jersey between them after stage one. But it all came together inside the final 800 metres again. Kyle Ryan looking to win stage one for United Healthcare as a sprinter there, as he did a year ago. But Taylor Finney launched a long one about 300-400 metres out, went, got in front, stayed in front. And what a celebration. I think that there won't have been a more popular winner around the world.
Mm. Brent Buchwalter, I think, wasn't it? His BMC teammate who sort of hit the front just behind him and let the gap open a little bit. I think you called it in the commentary, Rob, saying that it looked as though Taylor Finney was leading out Buchwalter, and perhaps the guys sitting behind him thought that. If that was the case, then it was a masterstroke, really. But, you know, you needed the legs. It's not a brilliant field, I don't think.
Well, certainly not as far as sprinters are concerned. This is very much a climber's race. Mm. Yesterday was one of the flattest stages, and the entire stage took place over 2,000 metres of altitude. You know, that's where we go up to in the Tour de France and the Giro d'Italia, Vuelta a España. We have two stages that back-to-back go over Independence Pass, 3,690 metres Independence Pass. People are going to react badly to the altitude. People are going to get nosebleeds. It's going to be a very unpredictable race. And in terms of sprinting, yeah, not too much to write home about. So if you're ever going to have a go.
But not to take anything away from Taylor Finney's win. A win is a win. He needed good legs to win. There are some decent riders there. It's one thing to come back to racing, but another thing to, you know, prove that you've still got the legs to produce a ride like that at the end of a stage, and it bodes well for what will be his proper comeback year next year.
Well, I think he did show that he does have the legs. He didn't just come back to make up the numbers, although the scars are visibly there. The kinesiology tape all over the knee, still supporting everything, was visible as well. Lots of it applied, but he looked good. He said he felt good. He said he felt like he was properly back, and that is the 10th victory of his career now. first for 16 months since he won at the Tour of California 2014, just before he had that horrible injury. He's back, and it set the race off to a super start in a year that, to be honest, a lot of people are quite worried for the race. Only four World Tour teams have turned up in a year when we have a World Championships on North American soil. I, for one, thought that you'd get quite a few more teams and big names going over this year and maybe spending a month over there. And well, a lot of people choosing either the Tour of Britain or the Vuelta a España, the more traditional routes, or certainly recent routes, to go and to winning things. But no, it set up a fantastic race this week, and of course you can watch it all week right through to the end on British Eurosport.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast and British Eurosport, the home of cycling.
Yes, Rob gave a little plug to British Eurosport, our sponsors, and their coverage of the USA Pro Challenge this week. But coming up, starting on Saturday, is the Vuelta a España, the third Grand Tour. Live coverage on British Eurosport throughout the race. We're going to talk a little bit about that now, the Vuelta, look ahead to the route and the riders. Fascinating race in prospect, I think. A fantastic field. The only rider missing, really, is the defending champion, Alberto Contador. Although, as we record, there have been rumblings and rumours that he might ride, but we're pretty sure he won't. We will stand corrected if in the next couple of days it's confirmed that he will ride, but Tinkoff-Saxo haven't named their team yet. But in the absence of Contador, you have Chris Froome, the recent Tour de France winner, Nairo Quintana, who was second, Joaquin Rodriguez, a very strong Astana team, Vincenzo Nibali, Fabio Aru, Mikel Landa. Lots to look forward to, really. Daniel, can you give us a little rundown of the route? It's always tough, the Vuelta route, but is it a particularly hard one this year?
Well, listeners might remember we spoke to Javier Guillén, the director of the Vuelta, back at the launch in late last year, and he was very proud of a route which is very mountainous, as the Vuelta always is now. I think 10 mountaintop finishes, or 10 hilltop finishes anyway, all of them new for the Vuelta. The Vuelta has never visited any of them before. I think 5 in the first week, hilltop finishes. All kicks off with a very short team time trial from Puerto Banús. The weekend on Saturday starts kind of on the beach. I think Rob knows more about exactly the kind of unusual circumstances in which that's going to start.
On the actual beach?
On the actual
On the sand?
Beach. Javier Guillén is very excited about the fact that this time trial goes over 5 different surfaces. It could be, you know,
we'll not get sand in their chain.
One would think so, wouldn't we? Sand, sea. I don't know.
This sounds like a Grand Tour made for Ciro Scognamiglio. Is Ciro going to be there?
Finishes in a disco on a dance floor. Anyway, that's the first stage. And then the first week is going to be very exciting. There's an awful lot happening in that first week. And this is a pattern now. Lionel's not here, but he likes his pattern. So I'm going to speak on his behalf about this pattern of first weeks in Grand Tours being full of fireworks now, really. And there'll be a big sort out of the general classification riders. You know, Chris Froome might be a bit undercooked. I think we're hearing from various sources that he might have on a kilo or two since the Tour de France. I don't think he's been training particularly well, as hard as he had been before the Tour de France.
Well, I can correct you there, Daniel. I've spoken to Chris Froome quite recently, and he has trained pretty hard. He's ridden a lot of criteriums. He's done 9 post-tour criteriums, but he's been doing a big block of training in this period as well. I think ended at the weekend. It left him quite tired for some of these criteriums. Not that that was usually reflected in the result. We touched last week on how the post-tour criteriums work, that the results are not always entirely due to the type of racing that's been happening. I'm not really explaining this very well at all. The races are fixed, basically, is what we're saying. The Froome was caught out at the weekend. He was racing in a criterium in Holland, and it started with a lap time trial, so a lap of the circuit timed. And he imagined that the finishing order would be somehow prearranged. He coasted round and was quite shocked and disturbed to find out that he was placed last in that particular element of the competition. Anyway, nonetheless, these races, in inverted commas, do take something out of the legs. I think he has combined it with quite a hard block of training. We'll see what kind of form he's in as the Vuelta unfolds. He's also up for the World Championships in Richmond later on.
However, that first week is going to be punishing, unforgiving, isn't it? And that might apply to some of the other leaders who rode the Tour de France. Nairo Quintana, of course, for Movistar. Federico Bahamontes,
is he riding?
No. The
The Eagle of Toledo.
The Eagle of Toledo, famous windbag of Spanish cycling. We can forgive him because he's a lovely man, and he's a very fit-looking 87-year-old, but he's always, you can always count on him at this time of year and at any time of year to hold forth on what current riders should and shouldn't be doing. He suggested in the Spanish press yesterday, I think, that Quintana rode a very poor Tour de France, was too defensive. He should have been attacking at the bottom of every climb. So presumably Quintana's taken on board that advice, and when the road goes up for the first time next week, he will be attacking. He'll attack probably from the gun, in fact, on stage.
On the beach. T-shirt eyed, the old Spanish windbag.
Kind of like a Jeff Boycott of cycling, isn't he, Federico?
Roger de Vlaminck. Spanish Roger de Vlaminck.
Or the...
Minus the llama. And the hair transplant. She's got magnificent thatch for someone of 87, in fact.
Daniel speaks enviously, and as somebody who knows a thing or two about magnificent thatches.
I have to say, in addition to week one, the weather. Spain's had one of the hottest summers on record. We're going starting in Andalusia, which is always hot at this time of year anyway. We're talking 40 degrees plus in the day. If it's hard with those five uphill finishes in the first week, it's going to be made extra hard by the fact that it's going to be baking hot every day.
It's a very bitty route, isn't it? There's a lot, you know, looking at the map, there's a lot of transfers. It looks more like Tour of Britain than the Tour de France. There's stages all over the place with big transfers in between.
Tour of Britain on that front. Javier Guillen, the director of the Vuelta, confirmed in the Spanish press this week that he has had requests for stage starts, or presumably, what do they call the Grand Depart in Spanish, Rob?
They don't have a particular name for, no. They don't get involved.
Well, that's good. Okay, that's good, because we abhor that rubbish, don't we? The grande partenza and that rubbish. Anyway.
Well, the Giro is a big start,
yeah,
is what they call it.
The big start, the grande partenza, nonsense. Anyway, there have been requests from Great Britain for stages of the Vuelta and various other countries. There were a lot of rumours about next year's start being in Porto, in Portugal. That's not going to happen now. And I think, reading between the lines, in the newspapers, in the Spanish newspapers, I think that's because the Vuelta is actually surfing a bit of a wave at the moment, unexpectedly, because, you know, for years we'd said that it was in grave difficulty, this race, but it's really had some fantastic races the last few years, and I get the impression that people in Spain are really opening their eyes to the commercial opportunities that it offers, and I think that perhaps they had an offer from Porto and now have thought better of accepting that.
An idea for next year: why don't they have a couple of stages of the Tour of Spain in Britain and a couple of stages of the Tour of Britain in Spain at the same time, because it runs simultaneously? You could do a sort of Erasmus style exchange.
Well, it costed El Sol anyway, isn't that Britain?
this reminds me, actually, I wrote a piece in Cycling Plus recently about what cycling would look like in 2025, speculating about how Britain in cycling terms would go from boom to bust, but by this time Britain would already have bidded successfully the start of the Vuelta, and this would be accompanied by headlines in the local press, que by gum. People will not know what to make of the Vuelta in España being in Yorkshire. Anyway,
on the subject still of Spanish cycling, though, one of the reasons for the doom and gloom around Spanish cycling was the dearth of young talent, and I think just it shows you how quickly that can change. I mean, Mikel Landa is one, but there are other young Spanish riders suddenly starting to emerge, aren't there?
Well, calling Mikel Landa Spanish might be a bit controversial.
All right, he's Basque.
No, just because of what he seems to have as his own particular feelings.
Who does he represent at the World Championships?
Spain, but I think if he could choose, he might well choose to represent Euskadi. Going back onto the subject of Guillen, business and Spanish cycling, he was actually on the radio this week. The only thing he was lamenting was the fact that the Spanish football season has sort of started a week ahead in the last couple of years, and he wanted that sort of big start, if you want, grande partenza, whatever it is. He wanted that to have its own weekend before the football season got going. The basketball, which is the second biggest sport in Spain, is also kicking off very soon as well. And that was the only thing that he was lamenting, really. But he said, really, we can't complain. TV money's going up. We've just signed a lot of new sponsorship deals for quite a few different years. So he'll be one of those hoping that the Vuelta stays at 3 weeks when all this reform comes in from the UCI. But really, really happy with how things are going. He said, yes, they've had to tighten the belts in certain economic factors, but going really well, and hoping that the fantastic start list they seem to be getting continue as well. He said the only thing that would have made this perfect would be Alberto Contador being there. He admitted to being on the phone to Contador and Tinkoff Saxo, trying to get him over there, like they do every year with every single big racer, but it would not be possible this year. And as Daniel said, it's going to be a really interesting opening week.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Download old episodes absolutely free at thecyclingpodcast.com.
still talking about the Vuelta a España, which starts on Saturday. We will obviously be talking about the Vuelta over the next few weeks. We've had a few questions asking if we're going to be doing increased coverage of the Vuelta. We'd love to really give the Vuelta the sort of treatment that we gave the Tour, or on a slightly smaller scale. Resources mean that's not really possible, but something we're looking at for next year, certainly expanding our coverage at the Grand Tours, and we'll be looking for sponsorship perhaps to that end, or other sources of income if anyone's got any great ideas. But we'll try and do as much as we can during the Vuelta, but it'll depend a little bit on circumstances. You're heading off soon, Daniel, on a little extended sabbatical. Can you tell us anything about that, or is it top secret?
People are that interested, are they? I'm moving to Berlin for a while, leaving Rob behind.
Yeah, no, you're probably right. They're probably not that interested, to be fair. But Lionel and I will be manning the ship, and you'll be appearing odd weeks because you'll be floating to and from Berlin a little bit. But, you know, Daniel's...
come on, check up on me every so often, and make sure I'm doing washing up and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, the home of cycling is working well.
Emptying the dishwasher, that's a big one.
Yeah. No, well, that's...
checking for Mousy. We've got a mouse. Anyway, go on, carry on.
The Vuelta. So, as I mentioned earlier, it's a brilliant field, certainly from the overall point of view, and very, very few people missing. Question marks over the form of Froome, I think.
And the role of Thomas, no?
Yeah, well, Geraint Thomas and Sergio Henao is another rider who's going there, who's won a stage of Tour of Poland recently and is in good climbing form. I think that Sky will go there with a multi-pronged approach, perhaps not, you know, perhaps open-minded to the fact that Froome might not be able to back up on the Tour. But if you're talking about Geraint Thomas, the question has to be, what kind of state is he going to be in? He's been riding hard all year, you know, big classics campaign, big Tour de France for him. Don't really know what kind of condition he's going to be in at the Vuelta.
No, the one thing that Sky have in their favour, I think, compared to perhaps Astana, for instance, is it'll be a united front, won't it? There'll be no dissension in their ranks. I wouldn't imagine, unless Henao is already looking ahead to next year. We don't know where he's going to be riding next year. I think he's out of contract. Astana will be fascinating because they've got Fabio Aru, who didn't ride the Tour de France, Vincenzo Nibali and Mikel Landa. Landa, of course, we're pretty certain is leaving for Team Sky. Aru and Nibali we've suggested in the past, and our great friend Ciro Scognamiglio, who we're missing dearly at the moment, he has suggested they don't particularly get on that well. They're not enemies by any stretch of the imagination, and they've got to find a way of dovetailing at this Vuelta a España. They also have their various clans. Astana operate a system whereby the two stay very separate for most of the year. They train separately, they have their own domestiques, to a certain extent they have their own staff, soigneurs, etc., who look after them on a regular basis. But recently they were united at Sestriere, the altitude camp, for the last block of training before the Vuelta a España. So it'd be fascinating to see. I presume the first director there will be Giuseppe Martinelli, who is the main director at Astana. It'll be fascinating to see how he uses his resources, and also Landa. Where does Landa fit in?
It will be very interesting how Landa does in his second Grand Tour this year, and to see whether, you know, the result, the performance at the Giro was a flash in the pan or an indication of what he's actually going to be capable of over the next few years.
Yeah, I think everybody knew that he was part of that fantastically talented group that came through in the last couple of years at Euskal Del. We've seen a couple move on. Movistar, Sky have benefited from Mikel Nieve, who won that brilliant stage to Gardeccia a few years ago back in the Giro d'Italia. Is he more talented than the likes of Nieve, maybe in Chausti and people like that? We're probably yet to see. Maybe he's already achieved a bit more already on general classification, showing the Giro d'Italia. But again, this year's Giro was a rather strange one, and he was in a fantastic team that bossed the race for much of the race. And he was part of that team that was, for a long time, was racing for Fabio Aru. Giro's still out for me.
I think it'll be interesting to see how the configuration of the Vuelta and the configuration of the mountain stages suits these riders or doesn't. It's not like the Vuelta is different from the, or certainly this year is different from the Tour and the Giro, in that the climbs don't come in big blocks. You tend to have isolated mountain stages, then a more rolling or flat day, then another mountain stage. There aren't a lot of back-to-back mountain stages, but we do have this one monumental, awful stage in Andorra, which has been described as by various people as possibly the hardest
Grand Tour stage of all time. Six huge climbs. A finish at the Quartadas del Camp, I'm not sure how they pronounce that in Andorra. Some very, very difficult climbs. And I think that could be, well, certainly one of the deciders. And that comes midway through the second week.
Talking about that Gaudete stage I mentioned a minute ago, it's very similar to that up in Andorra. It's very much Pulito Rodriguez country. He's, of course, Catalan rider, lives up in the only sovereign Catalan-speaking nation that there is, which is Andorra. Trains up there a lot as well. But I know a lot of the riders who are based up in Girona and Catalunya also train up towards there. So a lot of people should know the roads. They've had a lot of time to train on them. And it'll be really interesting to see how they go about that, because, as Daniel said, it's pretty brutal.
A couple of notable Americans, or three notable Americans, I suppose. TJ Van Garderen with a lot to prove after he was forced out of the Tour with illness. First time he's ridden a Grand Tour other than the Tour. Joe Dombrowski, who won the Tour of Utah recently, and Andrew Talansky, also in the Cannondale Garmin team. That's Cannondale. Cannondale Garmin, Rob and Daniel, not Gannondale Carmen. I think, Rob, you were caught on by eagle-eared listeners of the podcast, caught you the other night on the USA Pro Challenge, describing the team as Gannondale Carmen. It's obviously what you call it in the home of cycling.
Just a monumental cock-up, I think, no more than that.
Sounds Geordie, doesn't it? Gannon. Now, was it Gannon at the game?
Sure. What do we expect from the Americans, Daniel?
I thought you were doing this bit. Okay, so we got Talansky, we've got Dombrowski, and we've got, who's the other one?
TJ Van Garderen.
Well, Dombrowski will be an interesting one, because
I think he could win a stage.
Yeah, this could be a breakthrough Grand Tour for him. He's certainly come into form and really seems to have found his way in professional cycling now. Talansky and Van Garderen, it's not a route which on paper should necessarily suit them. The climbs, well, having said that, the climbs aren't as steep as they have been necessarily in past Worlds. There are a couple of summit finishes where the final climb or the penultimate climb is very steep, but not in every case. So who knows, they could pull something out of the bag, and Van Garderen certainly will feel he has a point to prove with Richie Port's arrival at BMC imminent. And Cannondale Garmin have started to pick up recently, have they? Their results have really picked up since the summer, so a bit less pressure on them, but Talansky will nonetheless want to lay a marker down, I'm sure, ahead of next year, when it looks as though he's going to have a bit more freedom, perhaps, at Cannondale Garmin, with the mooted departure of Daniel Martin.
Dan Martin, who's also riding. I don't expect Van Garderen to be challenging for the podium. I can't see it. Dombrowski, he is starting to find his feet, as you say, Daniel. And you have to say, is he not a guy who should have been at Cannondale Garmin, or what was Garmin, from day one? It just seems to be the type of team, the type of environment that suits him better than Team Sky, where he was before.
You mean he's preppy? That's what you mean.
I think he's a maverick, Daniel. That's and it's a team of famously of maverick.
I mean, he's preppy and writes nice blogs.
I don't think he does write nice blogs. I don't think he writes any blogs.
He strikes me as the kind of guy who would write nice blogs.
He should write a nice blog, definitely.
Anyway, TJ Van Garderen. Moving on to TJ Van Garderen. Yeah, there might be a bit of pressure on him, but he's got a good team around him. I'm not convinced he can make the podium. I think there's too much quality for him to make the podium. But he's got Darwin Atapuma there. He has Alessandro Marchi, who's strong in the climbs as well. And when Juan Ars there, who's rode a really good Giro d'Italia at the last minute. Samuel Sanchez in fantastic form at the Tour de France. Back riding the Vuelta when I think he probably thought that was it for him after last year. And Vuelta podium finisher Peter Velits as well.
Vuelta runner-up Peter Velits. Owner of some of the best hair in professional cycling.
Well, and another favourite of yours, Daniel, Kenny Elissonde, riding for FDJ. Former stage winner in the mountains. Little fella.
Former winner on the Angliru. He's really struggled the last couple of years. He's someone who struggles to find races that are mountainous enough for him. He's a tiny rider and really thrives in the steep stuff, but yeah, I mean, he's the kind of guy who could get a stage win. He rode fairly well in the Giro d'Italia earlier this year. I personally think that Fabio Aru will be very, very hard to beat. People forget that before the Giro d'Italia, there was much debated, much sort of speculated about bout of dysentery that he suffered from just before the Giro d'Italia, which may have hamstrung him and weakened him slightly. This time, there have been no setbacks before the Vuelta, and he rode a fantastic race last year, really extraordinary race in very exalted company with Contador and Froome. So I think he'll be very difficult to beat, and you know, bearing in mind that Nibali has been sent there, it almost seems more as punishment than as part of any kind of strategy on Astana's part. I think that Aru will sort of ease into a leadership role in that team, and I think it'll be tough to beat. And you know, I droned on about the pendulum factor at the Tour de France and Nairo Quintana, and how as the race moved towards the Alps he would come into his own and get stronger and stronger. You know, that could also happen at the Vuelta, but as I said before, I think the way the mountain stages are scattered around the route, they're going to be spectacular. The stages are going to be short, and I think it's going to favour very, very explosive climbers, which is not necessarily Quintana's profile.
Nevertheless, I think we should wrap things up there, but I think we should put our cards on the table and predict a podium. It was relatively easy at the Tour. The Tour, we started with these four overwhelming favourites. With each of these guys, the four favourites, there wasn't any question really about whether they were going to lead their team or not. So it was fairly straightforward. We've got a number of possible permutations at the Vuelta. But nevertheless, let's each of us pick a podium, right? I'll go first. despite what Daniel's just said, I will go for first. Well, I'll go in reverse order, okay? Third, Joaquim Rodriguez. Second, Fabio Aru. First, Nairo Quintana. Nairo Quintana. Let's say almost Jordi. Daniel, podium.
Shall we do the rest of the podcast in Jordi? Right. I'm going to go very similar, actually. How have we come up with...
That's why I wanted to go first.
I'm going
to
say Rodriguez, Quintana, Aru.
I think Alejandro Valverde is going to be on there somewhere. And I'm not sure about Quintana. I'd dearly love him to be up there because I'm a big fan of his, but I would have to say...
You're not supposed to be a fan, sorry. Well, yellow card.
I'm not commentating on this, it's a rare occasion where I can say that I think they'd like to do well. Yes.
I would say
Aru in third position, Rodriguez in second, and the winner is Valverde.
The winner is Valverde? That's controversial, very controversial. Ah.
Pressure off, I'm not working on this race.
We will return to these predictions at the end of the race. Daniel, you got something else to say? You're looking at the start list.
No, I always like to pick out, you know, I've got this theory about every 50 years or so there's going to be a Tour de France a la Walkoviak, Roger Walkoviak, who won the freak.
This is not the Tour de France, you know.
No,
that.
No, in 1951, wasn't it? And I always like to imagine who could win if a break went down the road. Got 40 minutes, just a fuga bidone, as they say in Italy. I always like to pick a name out.
Who's your wild card then? Well, Ian Boswell.
First name I've seen.
Grand Tour debutant for Team Sky.
First name I've seen is Mike Toynison from Lotto NL. And he's actually riding very well at the moment.
Yeah, but well enough to win the Vuelta.
What if lightning strikes twice and you have David Arroyo? Because he almost did that in the Giro a few years ago with that fantastic break.
Igor Sillin.
Okay, there's your wild card. My wild card will be... Daryl Impey. He will win the Vuelta. No, he won't really. Right, listen, let's wrap up there, chaps, or we're going to be wittering on for far too long. Rob, hopefully you'll join us again soon, especially in Daniel's absence. You can stand in for him on the odd week occasion. We've got a rota, obviously, of guests. You are an exalted company with Ned Bolting and Orla Shinoui, so we'll rotate you. They don't know that yet, but we'll tell them soon. Rob,
where I live anyway.
Yeah, Rob, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.